Johnson, what are some of the more important prejudices and behavior patterns that he had in mind?
Well, it's a little hard to define either prejudices or behavior patterns in a way that's very meaningful. I suppose he perhaps meant such things as following the same techniques of production as they have over the years, of having certain family attitudes with respect to the controlling the number of people, and considerations of that sort.
Well, in both China and India, I think you find the family is the cornerstone of the social structure. They don't have social security in China. A Chinese farmer has a large family to provide for his old age. It's a pure manner of survival. So he obtains his economic security to some extent from having a large family. In addition, in China, ancestor worship is an important part of their attitude to life. And as an outgrowth of that, throughout China, you'll find that in agricultural regions, 3-4% of the land may be devoted to graves. Excellent land, which could be used for increasing agricultural production.
Yes, I agree that that's perfectly true, but I don't want to have this question of prejudice overemphasized. The peasant farmer in any land, he's conservative, and he likes to be absolutely convinced before he changes his ways. And he's very right over that. But the point I'd like to make is that at the present time, especially as I know India, the changes are enormous and the changes are very rapid. You see, we've got more or less the caste system swept on one side, and since India and Pakistan became self-governing countries in 1947 in the British Commonwealth, you've got all these little principalities have been joined together. In fact, the Indians themselves have done so much in that way which the British Indian government I don't think could have done from outside.
Yes, I think that's very true, though I suppose we might come back just a second to Mr. Kennan's point. Perhaps one of the sort of things he's speaking about in terms of prejudices is the case of the sacred bulls and cows in India.
You want to tell us a little bit about that, Mr. Tang?
Well, yes, I think people know that the sacred bull is allowed to wander about much as he likes. I think you still get him in the streets of Calcutta sitting under the arcades of the Grand Hotel and liable to fall over him if you're late back at night. Well, it seems strange to us. But then you see the cow and the bull, after all, they're the basis of so much life in the country, it's no wonder that they're revered.
A moment ago, you said some of these behavior patterns and prejudices were being broken down quite rapidly in these countries.
Is that true? That's true. I think it's very marked with the, what we call them, the upper level of the people in India. The students in the universities and colleges, men and women working together in a way which they didn't 5-10 years ago.
I'd like to put you on a spot here, Stamp, on this question of breaking down prejudices and behavior patterns. You say that that's happened since the colonialism of the Dutch and the British has been wiped out in those countries. Did the colonialism of Western Europe tend to perpetuate these behavior patterns and prejudices?
Well, I'd just perhaps like to come to Mr. Stamp for the defense of these Western powers a moment. I suspect there's a great deal to be said for this, that one reason why the changes in India have been so rapid in the last 4 or 5 years is that the Indians no longer have the British as the whipping boy, as the cause of all their problems. And since things didn't materially improve the instant the British left, they had to look to themselves, to problems indigenous to themselves. And now that they're looking at these problems rationally, they're doing something about them.
Well, how do these religious customs tend to operate to cripple food production? I think you started to develop that, Stan.
Yes, I think there are some, but I don't know if one could pick out any particular ones. And as I say, I think the change is taking place. And, for example, with regard to cattle. Well, now we think of cattle producing milk. And you've got, for example, the dairying industry being developed in India at the present time. The change is taking place. One of the great troubles, of course, is the use of a goat in India. It's allowed to go all over the place, causes soil erosion and so on. Well, now, if we can persuade, or the Indians can be persuaded, that that's a useless animal or not a very useful one, then I think we may get improvement that way.
Up to this point in our discussion, gentlemen, you have set forth the many problems in the Orient that exist because of the terrific population and food pressures in these areas. You have developed in some detail the many causes for these problems. With this background in mind, I should like to ask this question. What is being done now to solve the problems you described? Eskin Shay?
Well, we're in the process of making a beginning, I would say. But the first thing that worries me here is how well equipped these nations are to solve some of these problems themselves. To an increasing degree, I feel that education is the cornerstone upon which we must depend to solve these problems in the long run. In both China and India, a large proportion of the population is illiterate. Until the people can communicate freely, you're not going to be able to bring about changes in agricultural techniques and so forth. They're short in technicians. They can carry on do the research work necessary to develop better agricultural procedures.
I think there's a point which we may be forgetting there, and that's the wonderful change which is caused by the use of the radio. You'll go to an Indian village today and you'll see the villagers sitting around their radio and listening communally. They're getting advice on farming, and although they may not be able to read and write, they can hear and they can listen, and that's making a great change. But may I refer, I think, at this stage to the Colombo Plan. Now, I think it may be known that the prime ministers, the premiers of India, Pakistan, Ceylon, and other British Commonwealth countries, notably Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United Kingdom, they got together at Colombo, and they themselves, these peoples, put forth a six-year plan for their own development.
I think your point, that last point you made, Stamp, is very important, that the Colombo Plan is a conception largely of the people who are involved.
Yes.
Here. That they, on their own initiative to a large degree, have brought forth a plan to solve their own problems. And then secondly, these countries in the Colombo Plan are, underneath the its conception, are supposed to supply at least half the capital involved.
That's right, yes.
The British government, I think, is going to plan put in about $1 billion in that, is it not, Stan?
Something of that sort.
Yes, I'm certainly glad that we mentioned the Colombo Plan, because I suspect that many Americans are not nearly as familiar with it as they are with our own Point 4 programs, and to a lesser extent, ECA. However, I'm afraid that the Point 4 is still more of a wish and a hope than any real program, that we're only really starting on it, and it has yet not made much contribution to these problems.
We haven't made much financial contribution under either of the two programs you mentioned, Johnson. But an interesting thing occurs to me here, that in Europe we found it an expensive proposition to support the ECA program. And some people fear the Far East or the Orient because it might be just as expensive. I think that a program can be developed for the Orient which is far less expensive, because their needs are of a different sort. They need some technical help.
Yeah.
They need aid in fertilizer. They need aid in medicine.
Yes.
And drugs and insecticides and so forth. Things that don't cost as much as some of the capital equipment that Europe needed so vitally.
I think two points should be made here, however. First of all, the Point 4 program has to have a much longer duration than we plan for ECA. In other words, we can't go into it for 2 or 3 years or even a decade. I think we have to assume that we have to carry it through for 20, 30, 40 years, if not longer. And secondly, even though the capital requirements will not be large at first in doing the sorts of things that have been discussed here, these countries will eventually want to industrialize. They will not want just to support themselves out of agriculture, which has never meant a very high level of living. And when industrialization starts, then the capital cost will become large.
Yes, well, now you've brought in industrialization, and don't let's get a wrong idea there. During World War II, of course, tremendous strides were made with factory industries in India. That's been going on for some time. But the net result is that you've got fewer people employed in manufacturing goods than you had before, because the old village industries, you see, have so largely gone. But look here, may I throw in a point here? I think perhaps we are still judging these countries too much from our angle of material civilization. You know, take the Burmans. What they want are not material progress so much in our sense as the leisure to enjoy life and to sit back and see the beauties of nature, that's really their objective in life. Don't forget it.
In other words, we have to develop programs in their terms rather than our terms. Is
Absolutely.
That what you're saying?
Yep.
I agree with that, Bourne, decidedly. I think the problem is to be stated like this. It is simple to tell a man that somebody is being unfair to him or unjust to him. But it's a different thing to tell him that he's doing his things wrongly or his productivity isn't done, his production isn't carried out by the right procedure.
Well, what about what should be done? I think we've been talking here about what is being done. What should be done in these areas specifically? Johnson?
Well, I would agree that we should extend extend further education. We should extend further technical assistance to aid these farmers to increase their productivity. And we should also do something which will help them bring population within reasonable limits. In other words, we cannot, I think, stand a population explosion in the Orient.
Birth control?
I say birth control is one aspect, but it's probably not the entire answer. It's not as simple as that.
We've got to enter into a phase of sociological engineering along the lines of birth control, in my opinion. Physically, it isn't possible to carry on birth control in these areas now. You lack simple means, and you don't have the sanitary facilities for such things. But in the long run, I think we have to come to some such answer.
Well, there's no doubt that we're dealing with one of the great world problems of the present day, and I do feel that these countries have got to work out their own salvation. They've got to give us their viewpoint. Let's help them. I'm not sure that I agree even with your approach to birth control. We've got to get it from their angle.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, but our time is up. You've been listening to the Northwestern University Reviewing Stand discussion, Population and Food Pressure in the Orient. In a moment, I'll explain how you can secure a copy of this broadcast. But first, I'd like to tell you about some recent Reviewing Stand broadcasts. In the last few months, we have analyzed such questions as, should gambling be legalized? Are the public schools doing their job? And who should be drafted? You can secure a list of these broadcasts by simply sending a postcard with your name and address and the words recent broadcast to the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois. A copy of today's broadcast with a list of books and articles about the subject discussed may be purchased for 10 cents in coin. Write to the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois. Our guests today were E.B. Eppenshade, Jr., D. Gale Johnson, George S. Tenen, and L. Dudley Stamp. Now our moderator, Leighton Boren, will tell you about next week's program.
Next week, the Reviewing Stand's broadcast falls on April Fool's Day. We will observe this interesting American holiday by discussing the subject, What Fools These Mortals Be. Our guest will be Bergen Evans, professor of English at Northwestern University and noted authority on the customs and mores of our culture. The writer, Francis Coughlin, director of continuity at WGN. And Mano Spahn, associate professor of German at Northwestern University. For a stimulating discussion of superstitions and practical jokes, we invite you to listen next week for What Fools These Mortals Be.
Remember the address for your copy of today's broadcast, the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.